You're listening to Star Wars Beyond the Films, the official expanded universe podcast of StarWarsReport.com.
There is a great disturbance in the Force.
Welcome to Star Wars Beyond the Film, Episode 6, airing on Middle Earth Network Radio. I am one of your hosts, Mark Herleman, today discussing Part 2 of Darth Plagueis, the novel, with Nathan P. Butler and Pete Morrison. Guys?
Hello!
Hello!
Hey, we're back. And you just got done, not too long ago, listening to our last one where we covered Part 1. And we covered this thing from forward to back, so if you don't want to be spoiled, go ahead and tap out right now, because we are going to go full force with this. And we're going to jump right into Part 2, Apprentice to Power, and it is going to span the years 54 to 52 before the Battle of Yavin. With that, we move into Riders on the Storm. Nathan, you want to take us away?
All right, with Part 2, entitled Apprentice to Power, as you mentioned there, what we get is a story essentially that has two different elements to it. On the one hand, we see Plagueis training Sidious, using the Sith names here, and in the process of that, we learn more about their views on the dark side. Among other things, we learn a little bit more about the idea of Force lightning to distort the human body. That's kind of cool. But we get all these Sith lessons going on. And then you flip it around, and one of the other things that we see happening is the broadening of the grand plan from a political standpoint. We get to see the birth, in many ways, of Palpatine's political career. How does he rise through the ranks? How does he gain a reputation? A lot of manipulations that are eventually going to bear fruit, of course, in Part 3, because this is Lucino. He's laying down the threads that will be picked up later on. We wind up in this part also being introduced, albeit not nearly as much as one might expect, to Darth Maul. A little bit of his origins, a little bit of his early training, stuff that winds up crossing over a little bit. They wind up making a mention that touches on, for instance, restraint from the new Shadow Hunter reissue of the paperback with all those crazy release ISBN number issues. This is a part that, just like the previous part, only interweaves with one story that I could find, personally, aside from the new stuff. The last one interweaved with the Tenebrous Way, but that is new. In this case, this also ties into the story of Vidar and Ronar Kim. If they sound familiar, they're from that one-off issue of Republic called Bloodlines. It was so cool because it was sort of a flashback within a flashback within a flashback that takes us through this connection, this relationship between Palpatine and the person we learn here, who is the former senator from Naboo, his mentor. Who it's mentioned that he's a senator. The mentor aspect is not played up nearly as much in the comic, but his mentor, Vidar Kim, and his son, who happens to have been taken to be a Jedi. It interweaves very well, and you get a very subtle hint of how well we're going to see things interweaving in Part 3 when he starts getting all that stuff prior to The Phantom Menace. So it's a political and a dark side development type of part here, which you would expect from the middle part of 3.
That's right. Pete, what'd you have to say on this one?
I particularly enjoyed the political development in the second part. It was pretty interesting to see, shall we say, the days of wine and impropriety, particularly where Palpatine is quite the ladies' man and enjoys a few cocktails.
Nice. I like the training aspect of this. I've said in the last episode about how much the lore really worked for me. Right out the gate, though, there was one line in the opening of their training on a planet. Kind of cutting through a herd, barehanded, killing. And one line made me stop, and it made me kind of go out their ways in Force philosophy. Sidious strikes at the animal and says, "The moment the vibroblade struck, the creature's eyes rolled back and grew opaque. Hot blood spurted, but quickly ceased to flow. The Force departing, and Sidious drawing its power deep into himself." Does that not sound like vampires to you, sucking the dark side or the Force itself out of a creature and getting powerful by it? I mean, that's where I went.
Dude, I'm, like I said, reading the Dresden Files. You're going to hear me reference that from time to time because I'm so immersed in the Dresden Files stuff right now. But the idea of sort of a soul-based vampire, an emotional-based vampire, is something you find in a lot of Eastern culture. It's more Western that you get the vampires that suck your blood. It's more Eastern that you get sort of the soul-based or emotion-based thing, and it really felt like they were playing these up to almost be like the White Court Dresden File-style vampires, the people who can feed off of that energy. And if you think about it, feeding off the dark side of some other being's pain or death, that kind of fits with the idea of how we see the Force flowing and such in the Tenebrous Way, where Plagueis is watching Tenebris die, and we get to sort of see the inner workings of how the Force is changing. But also, if you take this back to the recent release of The Old Republic, Revan, one of the things we find from Darth Scourge, one of his abilities, is that he's able to become more powerful by drawing upon the fear and the hatred and everything of those around him. It makes him very effective against live opponents, not as much against droids. There's a whole scene involving him fighting droids where he doesn't do as well, and they play this out as an explanation, almost kind of like the connections, though to a much lesser degree, to what the Exile, Mitra Surik, winds up having in the KOTOR 2 Sith Lords game. I love the idea that you can feed on these emotions. You know, it's not just your anger and hatred that can bring you down. It's sort of the guilt by association. The people who are around you, you know, we think of those people who are poisonous. Just their very presence can bring you down. They're always so negative. It's dragging you into a quicksand of their negativity, no matter how much you try to avoid it. That's perfectly played out here as a dark side metaphor. He's so just knocking it out of the park on everything about trying to give us new perspectives of the Force that feels so natural that we don't question them. We don't sit there saying, well, this doesn't fit with what I saw here. It's, whoa, that's like deep.
It's almost like it's also open to two different interpretations, because also in the recent release from The Old Republic, Revan, you have the Sith Emperor who consumes basically the life force of everyone on the planet to gain his power. So you have the Sith that not only can they absorb, like, as in a sense, a life force, but they can also absorb the emotions, as Nathan is talking about. So there's different sources of power the Sith can draw from.
See, and that's what I'm loving about this book right there. I mean, you know, we continue on and he's talking about how, you know, people don't know just how wealthy he is. He talks about his side as Hugo Damask. But then he talks about how, you know, his real bright is the dark side of the Force, what the ancients called Boga, as separate from Ashla. I mean, and he talks about the purity of Ashla. He goes on to talk about, he corrects Sidious about the so-called potentium theory, and he disregards it. I mean, there is so much going on with this guy. You know, I can't go on enough about what this guy represents to the EU when it comes to lore. This guy's got more of it going on than many of our role-playing game books, the core books, the chronologies, the essential guides. I mean, this one book, just blew me away by how much stuff Lucino tied together, and it felt so subtle. I mean, granted, some of it was just slapping you in the face, but at the same time, you're just kind of like, okay, what is this? Where'd that go? I love it. You know, Nathan, you mentioned the disfiguring. You know, that's all right there at the beginning. I mean, he talks about true Sith lightning has not only the power to incapacitate or kill, but physically transform the victim. And I love how he talks about how you have to actually take it in. You can't just have it or call on it in this sense. The true Sith has to be brought in. He goes, in order to summon and use lightning properly, you will someday have to be on the receiving end of its power as a means of taking the energy inside yourself. And, you know, we just talked about the different ways of taking life energy. Now you're seeing different ways of using energy. And I come to the sense of anything is possible in the Force depending on one's point of view at this break. I mean, you know, yeah, there's certain fundamental truths and stuff. But again, if your point of view is just right, I am pretty sure that you could use the Force to find a way around it.
And you see that in this book, in the Tenebris Way short story, you see them doing things that we haven't seen people do with the Force before. You see them experiment, like changing midichlorians. You see them going to such great extents. It's really kind of crazy the amount of power the Sith can call on at times.
And it's not just the Force usage here. I mean, we also have the sheer level of secrecy and the sheer level of plots here. We're seeing them continue to play out. I mean, we have in the first part, it's who's going to wind up becoming the next king of Naboo. And Bon Tapalo is the one that Plagueis is favoring because he's willing to open up the door to the Trade Federation and the Intergalactic Banking Clan and Damask Holdings and all these different companies for the plasma that's on Naboo, which coincidentally was discovered by that mining corporation who had been involved in trying to kill him and Tenebris back on Baldemic very early on. So he's sort of building on those threads where, oh, here's how he finds out about Naboo. Here's how Naboo gets drawn into it. Here's how Tapalo becomes a king. Oh, wait, who's Tapalo's his little aide there? The guy's like, was it prime minister or whatever? The person who's there working alongside is Ars Varuna. We've given him a first name. Now it's Varuna. He's going to be the king before Padme is. And they're sort of playing out these plots within plots, and I can see the Sith being able to keep secrets from others. What shocked me is the level to which the Sith can keep secrets from each other. Because it's always seemed to me that it was a little odd that, you know, Vader can be doing things like wanting to bring Luke to the dark side. You know, join me and we can destroy the Emperor and all this kind of stuff. Or even Anakin, when he joins Palpatine. There are some sources that assume that, yes, Palpatine knows how much he's loathing him. But, you know, Anakin's there saying, you know, I'm more powerful than the Chancellor. I can overthrow him. And, you know, there's all these plots within plots. And you would figure a Sith powerful enough to be the Sith Master should be able to not only understand that, yeah, the other one is there to try to crave the power, right? One to have it, one to crave it. But to figure out the specifics so they can stop those machinations when they are working against them. Instead here, we are introduced, to talk about lore, to the background of Darth Maul, which, by the way, does seem to slight... There's two things in this part that seem to slightly contradict other EU sources. The date for the death of Vidar Kim seems to be a little bit off from where it was originally. It just assumes that one of the characters must have been rounding when speaking very quickly in the comic, and then everything winds up working out fine. He's got to shift the events by, I think it's a year or two. You also have this thing where he being Palpatine in this case, Palpatine happens to be on Dathomir, studying Force-powerful worlds, because Plagueis isn't really wanting him to go to a lot of these Sith worlds just yet. And while on Dathomir, he runs into, I think it's Kysera, Cassina, I'd have to look at restraint, but he runs into the woman unnamed here who is Darth Maul's mother. And
Whoa, I need to know this right now. In that biography, is she really his mother?
You know, in the biography, they don't really say, at least not that I noticed. Instead, though, we do find sort of a blending. Ryder Windham tries to blend together the old background that said that he was a Zabrak from Iridonia with a new background where he's a Zabrak knight brother from Dathomir. And Lucina refers to him as a Dathomiri Zabrak, you know, which makes sense. You have a colony, essentially, and they wind up being dominated by the Night Sisters, blah, blah, blah. But in Wrath of Darth Maul, he basically says that Maul was born on Iridonia, but then very quickly taken to Dathomir, and that's where Plagueis winds up, or that's where Sidious winds up getting him. Thing is, if you look at that sequence actually in the Plagueis novel, it does not seem as though that is what they're getting at. I mean, granted, they don't go into too much detail, but she flat out says, they're asking about, you know, who's the father, who is this child? And the mother says, the child, whether yours or Palpatine says, the child, whether yours or not, is a knight brother conceived for the purpose of serving the sisterhood as a warrior and slave. And it seems like there's no attempt, at least not that I noticed, maybe I just missed a line, to say that he was from Iridonia, then winds up being on Dathomir. It sounds like they're trying to say that this woman, who is presumably the mother, restraint makes it sound like it is really her, his mother, gave birth to him on Dathomir. So that's it. Maybe it's an inconsistency. Maybe it's not. But that is one thing that stands out. But we get Maul's background finally, and somehow to the whole point I was trying to make about, you know, Sith being able to hide things. Was anyone else surprised at the fact that essentially Sidious is able to hide Maul's existence and early training, but his existence at least, from Plagueis initially? He has to tell Plagueis about it. Plagueis doesn't sense it.
Well, I wasn't surprised in the aspect of how Palpatine's powers manifested. It wasn't until he killed his mom, his dad, and his siblings that the walls that he had put up around himself since birth. I mean, apparently he was so powerful, like with the Inkori, his midichlorians were protecting him by hiding him. I figured the same thing must have been going on with Maul.
And I think this is sort of par for the course for the Sith, where they, not necessarily apprentices, but they're collecting valuable people or groups of people that they can use later on. So while he may not tell him about it, because basically Maul isn't a resource at that point, he's only an infant, there's not much he can do with him. But going back to sort of the origin story of Maul, what I found fascinating was the line about that he was a part of a, what did she say? He was half of a clan pair. So there were two children born. And then the mother goes on to say that the father was put to death afterwards. So going back to the Clone Wars series where this is tying into, it looked like the Savage Opress had another brother. And that's in the TV series.
Right, Farrell. But isn't Farrell younger than he is?
He might be. So the question I'm going back to is Darth Maul the other half of the clan pair? Or is he only a half-brother of Savage Opress? Are they half-brothers, or are they actual full-brothers?
That's a good question, because I had a different thought on it. I mean, I figured twins, but when I think of Savage Opress in the Clone Wars, he looks the same age Maul is in Episode 1. And that's like a 10-year gap there, you know? And so I keep thinking, well, what if we see in the Clone Wars, we see Maul's twin? That was where I was thinking, because it didn't seem like, okay, yeah, obviously they're going to make Savage's twin. But I was thinking, well, what if there really is an age difference here and Maul has an actual physical identical twin that we're going to find out about? You know, that was where I was running with it.
It could be. I mean, they don't go too much with Maul at this point. And the few times they mention within this section, it's when he's very young. What we usually wind up getting as far as finding out about his background and his training comes in Part 3. And it's mostly told through looking back on different things that had happened. But it's really an interesting thing that Lucino is trying. I mean, he pretty much had to do it, obviously. But he really is trying to connect this to the Clone Wars. And I'm wondering, you know, this is always going to be one of those unanswered questions, probably. But, I mean, this is the second time this book was commissioned. The first time it was commissioned, the project died. I don't know why. Maybe it was Lucas. Maybe somebody knows all the backstory of it. Maybe one of you do, but it died. And now the story's finally being told. They brought back the same person who was going to write it in the first place. They pick up where they left off. He starts writing this or rewriting this as the case may be. Now he's working in the Clone Wars stuff. I got to wonder, had it not been for the Clone Wars, or had it not been for this gap between when he first started writing it or started conceptualizing it before it was canceled and when he was able to pick it up again and run with it, you got to wonder how different that story might have been if told a few years earlier with different background material being prominent in his mind, you know?
Oh, yeah. I don't think it would be matching hand in glove to George Lucas's vision. That's for sure. You know, one thing, though, why I asked originally about Maul's mom about the bio, she was a human. They flat out called her a human female. And I found that very interesting, because if she is Darth Maul's mother, that makes Maul half human. And that's something that is kind of shocking when you think about it, because they've never called him that at all. So that to me leads to she's lying out her teeth. But like you said, with Maul had to, I really felt that chapter was shoehorned in there. Yeah, they did a good job of kind of telling us why Palpatine was there, but even that was kind of like, you know, limited. You know, we kind of got a taste of it early in the training as to why Plagueis didn't want him going to Korriban and Yavin 4 and all these places. But then Palpatine goes to other places that are not quite as bad kind of thing to get around it. But Maul's mom kind of seeking him out and giving him the baby did not make sense. That it wasn't explained well to me. That was the one reason why I docked the book a perfect score, was because I felt like it was just too shoehorned in.
Yeah, it's true. The whole, take him away from this. It'll be a different kind of servitude, but at least he won't be here. And I mean, that sort of works, and it would explain, you know, why Talzin would want him back so much, because he was given away essentially without her permission. But to your point about the idea of maybe Maul is essentially half-breed or whatever, the concept that they've been going with, or it seems like they're going with a combination of the Clone Wars and this, and the way Filoni and others have been talking about this, and, you know, maybe they even said something about it in that Night Sisters Trilogy Blu-ray documentary, but I remember having myself fuming so much at the fact that they completely left out Dave Wolverton that I've kind of blocked it from my mind. But when reading through this, it strikes me that if essentially the males are breeding stock, they are servants in breeding stock, we don't see in the Clone Wars cartoon any, as far as I remember, any Zabrak females in that group. We see human or pale human, whatever.
No, there were a couple. There were a couple female Zabraks with the Night Sister group. Yeah.
Okay.
At least two with the horns.
I was thinking almost all have to be half breed. So there is a Zabrak angle there. Okay, because it just didn't. It never struck me when I was looking at it that there was a Zabrak in the crowd. But then again, I was paying more attention to the how's it going to fit with other continuity than who's all in the crowd and how do they fit with continuity. I never would have thought about the half breed thing, because of course, when we're first getting ready to watch that, the idea of Maul coming back, that was ludicrous. Are you kidding? Maul can't come back. Certainly not. Have you ever heard of the tragedy of Darth Maul, the torso boy? You know, he can't come back. Never say never to Lucas, I suppose. What'd you guys think of the way that they, well, I guess I should step back here. I was going to say the way they worked Bloodlines into it with Vidar and Ronar Kim. First off, did you both read Bloodlines before?
Speaking for myself, I didn't read Bloodlines. I'm not that big of a comic fan. Most of my comic knowledge either comes from trade paperbacks occasionally or from just looking at Wikipedia. But without even reading that Bloodline story, the introduction of the character worked for me fine. And knowing the history of the Jedi taking children from parents fairly young, it worked well enough in the story that I didn't feel like I needed to go outside the story to look up who these guys were exactly.
Gotcha. Mark?
See, I recognized Kim right away. I had read the comic, and so once it started going in, I was like, oh. That was when I started realizing how many references were being dropped. Because at that point, I was just only connecting the book ones. And I was talking to William Devereaux over at EU Cantina because he'd read it before me. And he's like, well, what about the game references and the comic references? And I'm like, wait a minute, you're right. That one event happened. Because, I mean, even the Devarian version of Star Wars, I believe it was Star Wars 41 or 42 or something like that, was even referenced. It was like, wow, I was kind of shocked. The Maul ones, though, they slipped my mind. I didn't remember those as often. But everything that went down with Kim, I found it fascinating. I originally, when I first started reading it, I thought that Kim's father, I say Kim, they were both Kim, I thought Rohar's father was him at first, when I first started reading. I was like, wait, wasn't he a Jedi, not a senator? And then when they played it out, I love the way everything fell into place. And that was something I kept finding throughout the book. You know, it was like, it's set up here, and it started working in, and then down the road it would fill in. There were little things every now and again that you would get that you were hoping you'd hear more about, like when the Sith go to Cursed, I believe it was called, a planet where they were very back-cultured, and the Sith would always go there in groups. The apprentice would go there with his master, and then when he was the master, he'd go with his apprentice, and the culture would leap for every apprentice. By the time he came back as a master, they would see how far the population had come, and it was all based around these interactions with the Sith. When the Sith would show up yearly at a certain time frame, they would show up and go to battle. And like even that, you know, it was like a little throw-off whole paragraph or chapter, and I just found myself going, that would be an intense villain someday. I immediately went Lost Tribe of the Sith with it, going, ooh, the Sith are honing these guys for something down the road. And that was, you know, all the way through this book, I was just hoping someone somewhere is going to use something of it down the road, and just, you know, so much potential here in the EU where you could run with all these little stories. And the way he took old stories and laced them in to create new opportunities, I felt it was a brilliant work. I mean, EU fans, I think you're going to love the book. Fans that haven't read a Star Wars book, you may get thrown off by the politics stuff at the beginning, but by the time you get to part two, I think you're going to be enjoying the ride.
Well, speaking just of the idea of, you know, setting up others to be used later, like the people on Cursed, one of the people we get to see in a little more detail here as we're slowly getting to see Dooku interacting with Hego Damask, Plagueis, and interacting a little bit with Palpatine, we also get to see Sifo Dyas. And we haven't really got a whole lot with Sifo Dyas other than what we saw in that Visionaries comic way back when, where some of that's canonical, some of it's not. But there's these great conversations where it's like he's prepping Dooku and prepping Sifo Dyas to be open to suggestion later when the time is right to be manipulated. They talk about the unrest that's happening in some of the outer areas. Part of this whole plot is bringing in representatives from these outer worlds that can't be protected as easily and don't have as much money, and watching as they wind up going up against the Trade Federation to cause more and more unrest while they're playing both sides, kind of like what happens in the Clone Wars. And it talks about the idea of, you know, the Jedi needing to forge a peace, that the Jedi aren't armies, they're peacekeepers. You know, would they fight if necessary? And I don't want to go through the entire conversation. I'll take a couple snippets here, one from early, one from late, where essentially Sifo Dyas is asked by Plagueis, for the sake of argument, what if the disaffected systems raised an army? Wouldn't the Jedi be obligated to serve and protect the Republic? To which he replies, from where would these hypothetical armies arrive? The outlying systems lack the resources. And they keep going a little bit longer until finally we get to the point where Sifo Dyas is again asking about where this army could come from. And he says, out of thin air, unlikely, Magister, which is Hego Damask's title. That grown then, manufactured, you mean? No, I was being literal, but I only know of one group that might be up to the task, the group who grew laborers to work the mines of Sub-Terrell. I'm not familiar with Sub-Terrell. And then essentially the dark side like nudges Plagueis as if the time is not right. And it's like he won't say Kamino, but we know at this point he's already beginning the Kaminoans to try to breed Yenkori so that maybe he can use the Force to make them docile or commandable the way that he's able to do with the one subject that he has, only to realize that's not going to work. The fear for me with a lot of this backstory stuff was it would be a very pat explanation. Here's one scene that explains this whole big thing in the EU or in the films. And instead, it's all breadcrumbs. It's one thing leads to the next, leads to the next, leads to the next. And part two is very much for laying out those breadcrumbs, all the way leading up, of course, to the shocking ending that we get for part two as it leads us towards part three.
And without going back too far, I want to go back to that scene that Nathan was just reading from, because it was one of the parts in the book that just made me laugh out loud. Because why did the Force tell Plagueis to stop himself from talking? Because who walked by? That's right, Jocasta knew, our favorite librarian. That was just tremendous. I don't know what you guys thought about that, Mark.
I was going to hit the same thing, because, you know, Nathan was talking about how the feeling from deep in the dark side rose up inside him. The next line is strangling his voice box. Strangling. Again, the words Lucino used gives you the sense that the dark side is there. The dark side will help you. The dark side will corrupt you. And again, I love the different points of views. But the fact that, yes, Jocasta knew was there. And I believe Qui-Gon even was in that same scene. And it had, I mean, there was twice that Plagueis ends up kind of getting into a verbal little sparring match with Qui-Gon and Sifo-Dyas. And I like the fact that Qui-Gon kind of shows up, and we kind of see him like two or three times in the book, because, you know, he is a big player in The Phantom Menace. And by the time you get to part three, this whole book is like residing in Phantom Menace. And you're just like, what? How does that happen?
And it's great to see Jocasta Nu before she joined the cast of Golden Girls, isn't it? For the standpoint of the wrap up to this, though, I was shocked by the end of part two. Because, you know, we've got all these different rivalries that have been building up throughout here. You know, the Malastarian, what's the name of the species I'm looking for? It's dropping out of my brain. The Grand Protectorate are angry over some of the stuff that's happened throughout part one and part two. We even get a little bit of background on them with the Duggs and how they coexist on Malastar, which of course was necessitated by the Clone Wars. But we've got the Grand that are ticked off. We've got the Santh family from a mission that was decades ago. I mean, it's 25 years, I think it is, something like that, into the time when Plagueis was Tenebris's apprentice, and he says he's been Tenebris's apprentice, or was Tenebris's apprentice, for as long as a normal human would live, an average human lifespan. So this is years ago, decades ago. But finally, those threads of this anger that I thought going through it were basically just ways of showing that the Sith manipulate. And they don't care who they hurt once they've used them, as long as they get their use out of them. I thought that was the message. Instead, we get to this sort of, it's almost like I'm picturing it from the movie The Skulls, you know, with poor Joshua Jackson that everybody thought was going to be Anakin at one point. And I think Paul Walker was in that too, right, who other people thought was going to be Anakin at one point. It's like Duel of the Anakins. But you get to this sort of, this Lodge of the Canted Circle, and we think it's just, you know, he is there to elevate one of his flunkies, who's going to wind up leading the Intergalactic Banking Clan at one point before San Hill does. He thinks he's going to lead one of his flunkies there. He's going to join this prestigious order that Plagueis himself chose not to join at one point, and, you know, whatever. And that it's all just how to keep Plagueis away from Palpatine during a kidnapping that happens with Palpatine, only to wind up being that Palpatine's thing was not the biggie. And I was shocked to see Plagueis, they get the drop on him. They nearly kill him. Had it not been for Palpatine coming in, and it's the most brutal use of the Force we see from either of them, especially Palpatine, since the family was slaughtered. I'm totally taken aback when I'm reading. Literally, I'm rocked back. I sit the book down, sit up quietly, and I'm just thinking, woo, when that happened. What did you guys think of how that ended? I didn't see it coming, did you?
I didn't. I thought it was pretty crazy. And not only is it Sidious and Plagueis, but you also have Sidious's little cronies now. Now you have Sate Pestage with a blaster in there shooting up all the assassins. So it's almost like the Nixon's committee to reelect the president's starting to kick into the book.
Yeah, I was floored. I love, though, when the scene, when it all starts going down and Damask reaches up to his throat, I was just like, I was at that point, my jaw was just hanging. I was like, is this really happening? But I think one of the things we start to see as that chapter goes in, though, is Sate Pestage, him and Kim and Dorian. You know, their roles kind of start taking on more, like, they become like, I don't know, the Three Stooges in a sense, with Palpatine being the third stooge, you know, the three amigos, if you will. And At first I was like, where is this Kinman guy? You know, I was like, where have I seen him from? Outbound Flight. He played a key role in Outbound Flight. He ends up telling Thrawn that Sidious, Dark Lord of the Sith, is out there and all that. He's like the big reveal. And so the fact that him and Pistage know what's going on with the Sith, I found was an interesting thing. But it was Pistage that actually gets a hold of Palpatine, and he's the one that warns him. He says, the Maldernian commander I did business with during the Kim affair, what of him? He contacted me, too, maybe 3 hours ago. He said that he felt humiliated because of the manner in which the Kim contract had been implemented. He wanted to make it up to me. He just received word from the Maladin faction that it accepted a contract to carry out a major hit on Coruscant involving someone closely affiliated with Damask Holdings. I feared it might be you. And these connections, you know, it gets back to that whole feeling of, is the dark side really trying to win? I kept getting to that. You know, the whole talk of the profane and the force and the physical realm, these little things give you the sense that there is another battle going on. You know, we've talked about this when the New Jedi Order with Traitor. Is there a dark side? Isn't there a dark side? There is. You know, people go round and round. And I found that the little ways Lucino kind of puts it in Plagueis's mind, you get the feeling that Plagueis at least feels that there is a sentient side to the Force. And, you know, later on even, he feels like Anakin is like a complete slap to the face. Like the Force is coming back on him for something he did here during part two with his pregnancies, when he's really starts tweaking with the metachlorines and everything. And he really starts going overboard in his experimentations. I mean, he's been using Venomous, keeping him alive all this time to experiment on. He's got that Yinkari. I mean, all that's going on. And I just found these little references here and there, you know, were all something that kind of led into that overall sense of there's something more going on with the Force.
I will say that that was probably the most shocking thing. You mentioned there, I say most shocking outside of what happens at the Order of the Canton Circle. That blew me away. But the thing that had me going and had me expecting to finally find a confirmation that, yes, the Sith created Anakin, which, of course, we'll deal with in part three, because I think that's where they finally reveal the truth behind it one way or the other. But you get this point where Sidious goes to, I believe it was Sojourn, to meet with Plagueis after Plagueis has been in essentially seclusion after this attack on his life. And the droid essentially, 114D or 114, whatever, however you're supposed to say it, 4D. See, the Star Wars film's in 3D, but 4D is there now. And they're talking about, they're walking through on their way to see Plagueis. And he's asking him questions like, is Magister Damask your maker droid? And that sort of thing, just basic talk. And the droid lets it slip when pointing out all these beings that are in either stasis or in these almost like zoo-like contraptions. He says, these are the Magister's most recent pregnancies. And I'm like, his what? Pregnancies? And it totally shocked me. I mean, to hear them flat out say it, I'm expecting them to reveal that Anakin must be a part of this project. Of course, we're going to find that Lucina manages to give us a nice curveball again. But between that and things like, it's almost like a yo-yo he's playing with Venomous, the now you're alive, now you're dead, now you're alive, now you're dead. See, I can do it, I can do it, I can do it, was great because it gives us really a sense that, you know, that Sidious, when he says in Revenge of the Sith, you know, the power, whatever, I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, the power to overcome death or to cheat death or extend life is something that only one has mastered, but you and I together will find that secret. Whereas when he was talking with Anakin and just talking about the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise, which of course we find is, you know, it's a sarcastic term that he's using, it sounded as though, well, the apprentice knew it, so Palpatine should already know this secret. You really get a sense of the kind of knowledge that Sidious almost had his hands on that slipped out of his grasp, because there are just these few little secrets that Plagueis was able to pull off that Sidious just never was, at least not to the point that he is, you know, throughout this book. I mean, we get to the essence transfer thing, of course, with the clones that you've talked about before, Mark, but we don't really have a sense until now, I don't think, of just how much knowledge was lost to Sidious. By taking out his master, he ended any chance of actually being able to solve Anakin's problem when first seducing him. That was a nice touch.
Well, see, I also found at the end of this this part, Plagueis pretty much tells him, or maybe it's not this part, or it's right at the end. He tells him once he's mastered everything, then he will really start telling him the secrets, which he does. I mean, come part three, when that one kicks off, that's like the first thing he does is takes him into the library and starts really, you know, okay, we're going with this. But I like, though, how after the attack against the Canon Circle, it left Plagueis more like Vader. you know, or Malak. In fact, I believe that's one of the first times we see Malak's referenced about the old was Malak taken down or less powerful because Revan cut his jaw off kind of thing. And I love the way he came at him about it.
And that, I think that ties into some interesting discussion that can happen on Darth Vader and how his injuries either hampered him in the Force or didn't hamper him in the Force comparatively. Because on one hand, in this book, you seem to have Plagueis saying that the vessel isn't really as important as what's inside you, your spirit, your midichlorians, whatever you can control. But previously, it seemed like if you're injured, it does affect your ability to draw on the Force to some extent and caps your abilities.
Ooh, that's a very good point, because like we see later in Part 3, I believe during someone's death scene, Palpatine calls that out, which we'll touch on more.
And the other interesting part of the whole after the Canted Circle scene, I'm not sure if some of this is in Part 2 or Part 3, but you have Plagueis healing himself with the dark side, which previously you seemed like, I think it was in Dark Lord where it was talked about, where Vader couldn't keep himself healing with the dark side. He would have to try to use the light side, and it wouldn't, he couldn't maintain any healing.
Yeah, I want to say that that is either right at the end of Part 2 or right at the beginning of Part 3. Yeah, his skin was smoother. He was, yeah, I remember that. It was talking about how youthful he looked and how even though his body looked like he'd been, you know, mauled because of the breath piece he had on, the breather, that he was still just as powerful as he ever was in the Force, that none of, you know, the attacks had ever left their mark on him because of his mastery, which I felt, like you say, that plays into Vader later because, you know, you see in Lucino's first book, Dark Lord, how Vader is not used to his body and he's kind of coming to grips with things. But then you watch in other books later on and, you know, it doesn't seem to slow him down at all. And that does kind of make sense in that regard, that obviously he's mastered certain things. All right, guys. So with that, we get to Part 3, Mastery, which you will follow up on next week on our 7th episode of Star Wars Beyond the Film. Don't forget, you can contact us on Facebook at Star Wars Beyond the Films. You can also find us at Twitter at SW Beyond Films, all one word. You know, we don't have a sponsor yet. If you're feeling like you want to be a sponsor, hey, contact us. You can email us at beyondthefilms@starwarsfanworks.com. And again, you know, I can't stress it enough. Go on to Facebook, interact with us. Me and Nathan are pretty much there daily. You can also find our show at www.starwarsreport.com. For Star Wars Beyond the Films, it's been Mark Herleman.
And Nathan Butler.
And Peter Morrison.
Good night, everybody.